Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, is Democracy Now!
I saw things at Al-Aqsa Hospital which I still wake up at night thinking about. Appalling injuries in particularly women and children. The most devastating burns in small children. One child that I'll never forget had burns so bad you could see her facial bones. We knew there was no chance of her surviving that, but there was no morphine to give her. So not only was she inevitably going to die, but she would die in agony.
As Israel's deadly assault on Al Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, enters its fourth day, we'll speak to the British surgeon Nick Maynard. Gaza's medical system is on the verge of collapse as famine looms. Then we speak to the British-Israeli architect, Eyal Weitzman, the founder of Forensic Architecture. The group's new report documents how Israel's attacks on so-called safe zones in Gaza are part of a, quote, genocidal military campaign. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's assault on Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, has entered a fourth day. Al Jazeera is reporting Israel's blown up the entire specialist surgery center at the hospital. Israel has now ordered a full evacuation of the medical complex where thousands of Palestinians had sought refuge and medical care. This comes as Israel continues to attack areas across the Gaza Strip, including the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza.
We saw a frightening sight, body parts. We found the whole area destroyed. A whole area was hit with a belt of fire. They have not done anything. They don't know the resistance or anything. A mother and her children. Her husband is wounded inside. Her husband is an employee of the Palestinian Authority. He distributes gas. He has nothing to do with the resistance or anything. The whole area was hit with a belt of fire. And the children, as you can see, they have been dismembered. We're here collecting their limbs from under the rubble. There are children still there. We will bury them and then go search for others.
As the death toll in Gaza approaches 32,000, aid groups continue to warn of catastrophic hunger across the Gaza Strip. Umm Mohammed Slim is a Palestinian mother in Gaza City who said her son was killed while trying to get aid.
I want what I'm saying to reach the whole world so they can see what Israel is doing to the poor Palestinian people. We have been 6 months. 6 months. They are children. What have they done to deserve this? We are tired. We no longer have energy. The children in the south, in the north, are dying of hunger. What has a baby done to die of hunger?
On the diplomatic front, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's in Egypt today after a stop in Saudi Arabia. At the United Nations, the U.S. has submitted a draft resolution to the U.N. Security Council for an immediate temporary ceasefire in Gaza tied to the release of hostages. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Republican senators in a closed-door video conference that Israel would continue its assault on Gaza. Netanyahu reportedly blasted Democratic Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, who's called for new elections in Israel, and turned down Netanyahu's request to address Democrats. This comes as over 100 Democratic donors and activists have written to President Biden's campaign, warning the president's support for Israel's assault could cost him the election, saying, quote, because of the disillusionment of a critical portion of the Democratic coalition, the Gaza war is increasing the chances of a Trump victory. Unquote. U.S. lawmakers are moving towards cutting off funds for the next year to UNRWA, the U.N. Palestinian Relief Agency, despite the looming famine in Gaza. A massive new spending bill being considered by Congress would extend a suspension on U.S. funding for the agency until at least March 2025. Last year, the U.S. gave the agency $370 million. Australia recently became the latest country to resume funding the agency following a temporary pause after Israel claimed without providing evidence that UNRWA staff were involved in the October 7th attacks. Meanwhile, internal U.N. documents obtained by The Guardian reveal Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank have systematically harassed U.N. workers. Some have been beaten and blindfolded at checkpoints. Israel's also reportedly used UN facilities to fire on Palestinians living in refugee camps. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador blasted Texas's anti-immigrant SB 4 law on Wednesday as U.S. courts continue to wrangle over its legality. The law grants Texas authorities broad powers to arrest and deport anyone they suspect of crossing the border without authorization. This is AMLO.
Estamos en contra de esta...
We are against this draconian law, which is completely contrary to human rights. If they intend to do deportations, which is not up to them, we won't accept deportations from the Texas government, and we will not stand idly by.
The law is currently blocked after the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals moved to halt the measure Tuesday, just hours after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the law could go into effect. Immigrant justice advocates warn SB 4 would have devastating effects on immigrant communities throughout the state of Texas. This is Fernando Garcia, director of the Border Network for Human Rights.
If allowed to proceed, it would have a terrible impact on communities. We are talking about the fact that not only migrants crossing the border would be impacted by the state immigration policy of Governor Abbott, but in general, Texans, migrants in Houston, in Dallas, in Fort Worth, will be subject to a policy of persecution by local and state police, where they will be asking them for immigration papers, detaining them, and also deporting them to Mexico.
In Georgia, prison officials executed William James Pine, the state's first execution in over 4 years. 59-year-old Willie Pye was put to death with an injection of pentobarbital after the U.S. Supreme Court denied a clemency appeal despite his lawyers arguing he was, quote, intellectually disabled, unquote, and that the state of Georgia was not ready to resume executions after halting the practice during the pandemic. Pye's supporters and anti-death penalty advocates gathered for a vigil Wednesday ahead of his execution. Kathy Herman Christian is executive director of Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
On the death certificate, it will say homicide. The state is committing homicide. And that's what's on Willie Pye's death certificate. The drug itself for this particular lethal injection, to my knowledge, is a single-dose drug. And my understanding is that what it will do, it will boil. Willie Pye will experience boiling in his own blood.
In Mississippi, two more former sheriff's deputies were sentenced Wednesday for torturing and sexually abusing two black men in January 2023. Christian Dedman was sentenced to 40 years in prison and Daniel Updike to 17 and a half years. The men were part of a group of officers that call themselves the Goon Squad. A total of six officers have admitted to beating, handcuffing, waterboarding, and tasering Michael Corey Jenkins and Eddie Terrell Parker inside a home in a majority white county outside Jackson, Mississippi. Two other members of the Goon Squad were sentenced on Tuesday. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the U.S. Justice Department and lawyers for Julian Assange have had preliminary discussions about a possible plea deal that could lead to the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder being released from prison. However, Assange's legal team says they have been given no indication the Justice Department intends to resolve the case. Julian Assange has been held in London's Belmarsh prison since 2019, awaiting possible extradition to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison for publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes. In a surprise move, Ireland's leader, Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, announced Wednesday he is resigning, stating simply, quote, the time has come to pass on the baton.
No, inevitably there'll be speculation as to the quote-unquote real reason for my decision. These are the real reasons. That's it. I have nothing else lined up. I have nothing in mind. I have no definite personal or political plans, but I'm really looking forward to having the time to think about them.
At 45, Rutger is Ireland's youngest ever prime minister, or Taoiseach. He's also Ireland's first openly gay leader and first Indian and mixed-race leader. On Sunday, he called for a Gaza ceasefire as he joined President Biden at the White House for a St. Patrick's Day celebration. In Hong Kong, lawmakers unanimously passed a new national security law that further cracks down on dissent and free speech. Article 23 expands the definition of certain offenses and targets treason, insurrection, sabotage, external interference, theft of state secrets, and espionage. It also allows for closed-door trials and imposes harsher penalties, including life imprisonment in some cases. The bill's passage marks a major defeat for pro-democracy activists and critics of Beijing's tightening grip on Hong Kong. In related news, a Hong Kong court Saturday sentenced 12 people to prison terms of 6 to 7 years after they were convicted of rioting when they stormed the city's legislature during the 2019 pro-democracy uprising. Hundreds of protesters breached and vandalized the government building on July 1, 2019, the 22nd anniversary of Britain's handover of Hong Kong to China. Indonesia's election committee officially declared Prabowo Subianto the winner of the February 14th presidential polls, securing over 58% of the vote. It was Prabowo's third attempt after losing twice to outgoing President Joko Widodo. He'll assume office alongside Vice President-elect Gibran Rakabuming Raka, who is Joko Widodo's son. Prabowo, the son-in-law of former Indonesian dictator Suharto, the ex-son-in-law, is a U.S.-backed former general who's been implicated in mass killings in East Timor, Papua and Aceh, as well as the kidnapping and torture of activists in Jakarta. In environmental news, the Biden administration announced new rules curbing tailpipe emissions for passenger cars and light-duty trucks. The new standards call for a 56% reduction in average carbon emissions by 2032. The Environmental Protection Agency hopes the rule will help propel the sale of electric vehicles, or EVs, which last year made up less than 8% of all new car sales. While it's the greatest ever limits imposed on tailpipe emissions, climate groups criticize the EPA for slowing down the transition to EVs after the agency's initial proposal was met with backlash from the auto and fossil fuel industries. The Biden administration's announced another $6 billion in federal student loan cancellation for 78,000 public service workers. Borrowers will benefit include teachers, nurses, and firefighters who've been repaying their loans for at least a decade. And Republican efforts to impeach President Biden could soon peter out after a second hearing failed to deliver any evidence pointing to President Biden's involvement in his son Hunter Biden's business dealings. With Republican support for the impeachment eroding, Congressmember James Comer, who's leading the impeachment inquiry, said he's weighing possible criminal referrals to the Justice Department instead of a lawmaker vote. New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez blasted the impeachment attempt during Wednesday's hearing.
Clearly, what we are seeing here today is a continuation of the 15-month saga of the Republican majority lost in the desert. This resolution does not outline a high crime or misdemeanor. It's not here.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Gaza's medical system on the verge of collapse as famine looms. We'll speak with the British surgeon Nick Maynard, part of a group of doctors who volunteered in Gaza, just left the United Nations and are in Washington, D.C., expressing alarm over the humanitarian crisis. Back in 20 seconds.
نامي نامي يا صغيري تنغفى على الحصيري نامي نامي يا صغيري تنغفى على الحصيري نامي على العتيبين تتنزاح الغيب يضوي عكل الجيري نامي نامي يا صغيري تنغفى
Sleep, Little One by Marcel Khalifa and Umayma Khalil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Israel's assault on Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, has entered a fourth day. Al Jazeera is reporting Israel has blown up the entire specialist surgery center at the hospital where thousands of Palestinians had sought refuge and medical care. Israel has now ordered everyone to evacuate as it threatens to blow up the entire medical complex. The World Health Organization says it has documented 410 attacks on healthcare facilities since Israel began its assault on October 7th. We begin today's show looking at the collapse of Gaza's medical system. A group of international doctors who recently spent time in Gaza traveled to the United Nations and Washington this week to express alarm over the humanitarian crisis. This is Amber Al-Ayan with Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, speaking at the United Nations on Tuesday.
Two populations are particularly vulnerable: pregnant and lactating women, who were already facing iron deficiency anemia before the war, which puts them at risk for hemorrhage during birth. With the war, it puts them in a state of undernourishment or malnutrition, potentially malnutrition, which means that they can't breastfeed their children properly. The milk doesn't necessarily come in, and it's definitely not enough. And the other population is children under 2 years, which is the breastfeeding age. There's not enough space for us to work closely with the mothers to help them start lactating again. We can't even access them. And to be able to do that, you have to have day-to-day activities with those women, and that is not something that's possible for us right now. Those children need to be breastfed. If they can't be breastfed, they need formula. To have formula, you need clean water. None of these things are possible. What we're talking about is women who are squeezing fruits, dates into handkerchiefs, into tissues, and drip feeding their children with some sort of sugary substance to nourish them.
That was Dr. Amber Al-Ayan of Médecins Sans Frontières. Dr. Zahir Sahloul, the president of Med Global, also spoke at the United Nations on Tuesday.
This is Hiyam Abu Khadr. She's 7 years old. She is one of the victims of the war in Gaza. A bomb hit her family home, so her father and brother were killed, and her mother also was injured, and she had burned, and she sustained third-degree burns on 40% of her body. She was treated by one of our volunteers, Dr. Vanita Gupta, who is critical care specialist from New York, in the European hospital in Deir al-Balah. And Dr. Gupta took some videos of her, and you can see her face in the videos and also in this picture. And if you want to define post-traumatic stress disorder, this is what post-traumatic stress disorder looked like in the face of a child who's 7 years old. She was supposed to be evacuated to Egypt, and she waited for weeks before she was eventually evacuated, and she died 2 days after evacuation because it was too late.
And Professor Nick Maynard also spoke, a surgeon who led an emergency medical team in central Gaza at Al-Aqsa Hospital in December and January, former director for cancer services at Oxford University.
I saw things at Al-Aqsa Hospital which I still wake up at night thinking about, appalling injuries in particularly women and children. The most devastating burns in small children. One child that I'll never forget had burns so bad you could see her facial bones. We knew there was no chance of her surviving that, but there was no morphine to give her. So not only was she inevitably going to die, but she would die in agony.
And Professor Nick Maynard joins us now, the surgeon who led the emergency medical team in central Gaza at Al-Aqsa Hospital in December and January, again, former director for cancer services at Oxford University. Dr. Maynard, thanks so much for joining us from Washington. You were here in New York yesterday addressing members of the United Nations. Talk further about what you found and talk about how it compares. You've been going to Gaza for, the last 15 years.
Yeah, thank you very much for asking me on this morning. As you said, I've been going to Gaza since 2010 and have worked extensively in various hospitals in Gaza. And each trip, it's always very challenging. But there are circumstances we get used to. It's what I describe as normal Gaza for people who have been there. It's, of course, not normal by anyone else's standards because there's always a lack of resources. You're always wondering whether things are going to be running out. When you're operating the operating theatres, you always have to work with the equipment you're given. It's never quite enough. But of course, you manage that very well. What we've seen since October the 7th in the visits we've had to Gaza have been inestimably worse than that, and working under extremely challenging conditions with a huge lack of resources and working in a healthcare system which is being systematically dismantled by the attacks on it.
And Dr. Maynard, as you know, since you've returned, the situation has gotten immeasurably worse. If you could comment on the latest news about the sustained attacks on Al-Shifa Hospital. You said earlier, after your trip in January to Gaza, accusing Israeli forces of, quote, appalling atrocities as they systematically target hospitals and healthcare infrastructure in Gaza. So if you could elaborate on that and what you hear of what's been happening in the last few months since you left.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've witnessed myself attacks on hospitals. When I was in Al-Aqsa Hospital, we were forced to withdraw 2 days early because there was a missile attack on the intensive care unit. What's happening at Shifa Hospital now is really a replica of what happened in the earlier part of this war when Shifa Hospital was attacked and almost completely disabled. I have been in contact with a close friend who is a senior surgeon at Shifa to hear what's happening in the last 48 to 72 hours. And the same thing is happening again. The hospital, which had been largely disabled, had been beginning to function again in recent weeks and still at a much lower level than it had originally been capable of. But nevertheless, the staff there heroically treating their patients with limited resources. But again, they've been forced to leave. I've heard horrific testimonies of the medical staff being stripped naked, some of them being abducted again. And we are seeing really the horrors that we witnessed several weeks ago. And Shifa Hospital, of course, being the largest hospital in Gaza, the major trauma center, now again will be almost completely disabled, and there will be no healthcare services for those patients in Gaza City and North Gaza.
Well, as you know, Dr. Maynard, the UN has said that none of Gaza's 36 hospitals are at this point fully functional. You described your own time working in Al-Aqsa in January as perhaps the worst experience in your medical career. We heard you speak a little bit about this earlier, but if you could describe the conditions under which you worked there and what you saw, the patients that you were seeing, their injuries, if you could just talk about that.
Yes, we hear a lot about fully functioning and partly functioning hospitals in Gaza. I would argue there have been no fully functioning hospitals at all since October the 7th. The quality of care that I've witnessed in over the 15 years I've been going has been quite fantastic. Some extremely talented doctors and nurses and other healthcare workers providing a remarkably high level of healthcare provision despite the really challenging lack of resources. But even though there is talk about fully functioning and partly functioning, I would argue that even Al-Aqsa Hospital, when I was working there, the Nasser Medical Complex, the European Hospital, before they were attacked by the Israeli forces, they weren't fully functioning. They could barely cope, well, they couldn't cope with the numbers of severe traumas coming in. And really, since October the 7th, no hospital facility has been managing to treat patients without trauma, all the communicable and non-communicable diseases. So I don't think any hospital is functioning properly at all, and won't do so until there is a cessation of the military activity. When I was in Al-Aqsa Hospital, we had very limited resources. I was operating most days. I'm a surgeon, so I was operating on major blast injuries to the abdomen and to the chest. I saw appalling injuries, mostly in women and children, but also in some men as well. And we operated under very challenging circumstances. Some days there were no sterile drapes to use to cover patients, so we had to make our own out of gowns. Some days there was no running water, so we couldn't scrub up properly. We had to try and sterilise our hands with alcoholic gel. The equipment we had to use in the operating theatres was very limited. Very limited numbers of sutures and needles to use, and very few instruments sometimes.
Dr.
So,
Maynard,
really...
Can you tell us more about that little girl that you described at the news conference you held at the United Nations with the other doctors?
Yes. This was a little girl who was managed by one of my close colleagues from Oxford, Dr. Debbie Harrington. It was a little girl with severe burns whose burns were so severe that you could see her facial bones through the burns. There was no prospect of her surviving these burns, and we knew she was going to die, but there was no morphine available in the emergency room that day, and that was a frequent occurrence during our stay there. So we knew she was going to die, but she had to die in agony. There was no way of relieving her pain. And what made it even worse, if it could be worse than that, was the fact that there was nowhere for her to die in privacy. She was lying on the floor of the emergency room at Al-Aqsa Hospital. There was nowhere else for her to go. So she died in public and in agony. And we witnessed many other examples like that. And I could spend a lot of time talking about the horrible things we saw, people dying without dignity, without pain relief. And I bore witness to things I would never, ever have expected to have seen in any healthcare setting.
Dr. Maynard, can you talk about the condition of the doctors? A few months ago, we interviewed Dr. Hamam Allo, who was at Al-Shifa, and he would later die in a bombing. I had asked him, why doesn't he leave? And he said, you think that's why I went to medical school, to desert my patients? But can you talk about right now the number of doctors who have been arrested, who have died, who are hungry as they try to work?
Yes, I've been profoundly humbled by the healthcare workers that I've met in Gaza, some of whom I've known for many years, some of whom I've met during my stay at Al-Aqsa Hospital. They've been working non-stop under the most appalling conditions since October the 7th. I go out to Gaza with medical aid for Palestinians. They have some heroic staff on the ground there who, again, are working under appalling circumstances. One of them, who lives in northern Gaza, couldn't move south because of his elderly parents. They've been living on bird seed. They've run out of animal feed now, so they're now eating bird seed. I've met doctors and nurses who have been physically and mentally broken by what they're going through, but still carry on working, refusing to leave their patients, because that is what their job is. None of these people have been paid at all since October the 7th, and indeed many of them hadn't been paid for many months up till then. But they stay with their patients because that is their job, that is their duty, and they will not leave, despite the full knowledge that they may die as a result of that. So I am truly humbled by the people I've met there, both doctors, nurses, and some very close friends I've made in medical aid for Palestinians who work on the ground there.
Well, Dr. Maynard, I want to ask about another related issue, which is, you said that most of the people you treated were women and children. Now, of course, Gaza is on the brink of famine, and at least 27 children have already died of malnutrition as Israel continues to block humanitarian aid supplies. If you could talk about whether you already saw signs in January of the effects of insufficient food on the children that you were treating.
Yeah, you played earlier the very eloquent description by Amber of about the problems with malnutrition in women and children. We saw this when we were there in December and January. We saw at Al-Aqsa Hospital the paediatricians who we knew there were seeing two or three cases a week in December of kwashiorkor. This is the most severe form of protein-deficient malnutrition. And you may remember pictures of the various famines over the years we've seen in Africa with pot-bellied children. And this is the most severe form of malnutrition. And the paediatricians were seeing this in Al-Aqsa back in December. We saw evidence of, very clear evidence of malnutrition in some of our surgical patients in Al-Aqsa Hospital. Virtually all the patients get severe infective complications of their injuries and their surgery because of the conditions, the overcrowding, the lack of antibiotics, the lack of sterile procedures. And of course, when people get these infections, when they develop sepsis,